First case in our calendar is 03-2036, State of Ohio versus Rocky Barton.
Thank you. May it please the court, and good morning. My name is Chris Pagan. I represent the appellant, and at this time, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please. We presented four propositions of law for the court's review, and at this time, I'd like to address the first two that relate to the waiver of the mitigation hearing. The two propositions are interrelated, and that's why, and this court has addressed them together in prior case decisions, and for that reason, I'd like to discuss them jointly. I'd also like to start off with what's undisputed in this case. What's undisputed is that there was not an Ashworth hearing, that there was not an Ashworth waiver, that there were no findings of fact made by the trial court with reference to whether or not Mr. Barton made a knowing and intelligent waiver of his mitigation hearing. There was no competency evaluation. There were no trial court findings probative of competency. And there was, in fact, indicia presented by Mr. Barton of mental illness, to wit, his attempted suicide, which formed a part of the state's case in chief, and also there was evidence of his refusal to cooperate with trial counsel. None of these facts are undisputed, and all are probative of the issues presented in Propositions 1 and 2. What is at dispute is whether or not the evidence demonstrated that Mr. Barton waived all mitigating evidence. And I'd like to address that at this particular point in time. In its brief, the state represents to you four different factors in which it suggests that there wasn't a waiver of all mitigating evidence. And because of that, they argue that the result should be that that Ashworth should be excused. Those four factors are that the defense counsel made argument in support of his claim that the death penalty was inappropriate, that Mr. Barton permitted jury instructions to go to the jury, that instructed on mitigation, and that he argued using those instructions to argue against the imposition of a death sentence. Thirdly, that Mr. Barton provided an unsworn statement. And fourth, that evidence was elicited during the trial phase that was mitigating in nature. None of those four factors should be dispositive, and let me address them in order. With respect to argument is not evidence. It is neither evidence or mitigating evidence. Therefore, it cannot be construed by this court to excuse an Ashworth hearing. Jury instructions, secondly. Jury instructions aren't evidence. That is Hornbook law. It is not evidence nor mitigating evidence, and it cannot be utilized by this court to excuse away an Ashworth hearing. The other two factors, the unsworn statement and the trial evidence, are a bit more problematic, but the court should not be obstructed by it in determining that Ashworth wasn't followed. Let me speak to the unsworn statement. The unsworn statement in this case wasn't mitigating in any particular way at all. Now, the court has construed unsworn statements in the past to be evidence, but not mitigating evidence. And that's the important thing. This court has construed mitigating evidence under 29-2904B to be that type of evidence that calls for a penalty less than death or lessens the appropriateness of death. In his unsworn statement, Mr. Barton asked for the death penalty and explained his reasons why. But in asking for the death penalty, he wasn't presenting evidence that called for a sentence less than death or a penalty less than death. He was asking for death. And because that was the case, and because his mitigating statement didn't include any other factors that could be construed to be mitigating, this court cannot hold that his unsworn statement was mitigating.
Are you saying that the unsworn statement, the content of the unsworn statement, has to be looked at before it can be considered mitigating? I mean, your client had an opportunity to make the statement. He didn't remain silent with respect to any mitigation whatsoever, as some of our other cases have shown. So applicability of waiver here. I'm trying to understand. Are you saying you have to look at what the defendant says in his unsworn statement to see if it's mitigating or not?
I would agree. There have been, the content of the statement was this: I want the death penalty, and these are the reasons why. He went no farther than that. This court has considered other circumstances or cases where a defendant has waived all mitigating evidence except for the unsworn statement. Mink was a case like that, and Vrabel was a case like that. In both Mink and Vrabel, the defendants made unsworn statements. They requested the death penalty. And importantly, in Vrabel, this court, in construing that, specifically held that the defendant had waived all mitigating evidence. And I would argue to the court that in Vrabel, the court looked at the content of the mitigating statement, saw it for what it was. It was simply a short statement in which he asked for death and concluded that that was evidence but not mitigating evidence. And therefore, he had waived all mitigating evidence, which required an Ashworth hearing and a competency evaluation. So the answer to your question is yes, you do need to consider the substance of the statement to determine whether or not it's mitigating or not. There have been circumstances in death penalty cases that this court has considered in which mitigating statements have gone beyond just a request that the jury impose death. And in those circumstances, and the Monroe case comes to mind, the court has found that the unsworn statement did touch upon things that a jury would be able to consider to be mitigating. In Monroe, the defendant went on to explain about his problematic childhood, the difficulties he had with his parents, and that could have been and was utilized by the jury to consider whether or not that was mitigating enough to outweigh the aggravating circumstance. But that's different than Vrabel, and our case here is closer to Vrabel than it is to Monroe, to answer your question.
Thank you.
Trial evidence. That is the last factor that the state of Ohio presents to this court as going to its argument that there was, in fact, some mitigating evidence presented to the jury that would have excused the Ashworth hearing and the competency evaluation. But I would submit that the record doesn't bear that out. First of all, the only evidence that the state presents or points to in the trial record that reflects on mitigation was the defendant's cross-examination of the victim's daughter. And the daughter elicited evidence based on cross-examination that Mr. Barton had been connected to her life and a helpful stepfather. That was trial evidence, and it wasn't penalty evidence. And that's the distinction. Also, what's important is that the cross-examination came from defense counsel and wasn't probative or indicative of what Mr. Barton wished. When you look at the Ashworth syllabus, and I looked at this again last night to be sure, the focus is on the defendant's intentions or his wishes. And the syllabus goes on to say that when the defendant wishes to waive all mitigating evidence, and it goes on from there. So that's the focus, not what a trial counsel does, but what the defendant intended. And the defense, I would contend, that Mr. Barton's wishes or his intent is reflected in the record, specifically on page 1332 of the trial record, in which he indicated that he did not want to put on, and it was his intention and his wish, to waive the presentation of all mitigating evidence. That record, that particular statement, is reflective or probative of what he wanted. That's what Ashworth calls for, and that's why the trial evidence that the state points to is not sufficient to excuse the state from the Ashworth hearing that was not conducted in this case. Apart from the four factors that I've presented to you, I'd also like the court to consider what the state proposes with reference to whether or not it's a workable test. I certainly appreciate that you're not deciding cases in a vacuum and that you need to consider Ashworth as it's applicable to future cases. Having this court scour a record to determine whether or not evidence, no matter where it was presented, whether it be at the trial phase or the mitigation phase or at a pretrial hearing or at the arraignment, having this court be required to scour that record to determine whether or not some evidence, no matter how it was elicited and no matter under what circumstances it was elicited, to determine whether or not that was mitigating presents an unworkable test. because how is this court to know? There are many, many different reasons why evidence is presented in a death penalty case, and oftentimes it's presented for more than one purpose. And if in any circumstance a defendant, whether it be at any particular hearing, at any part of a trial, presents evidence that could be mitigating, well, if that's the case, then we'd never have a reason to have Ashworth hearings. Secondly, if you take the state's argument and follow it to its end conclusion, there would again never need to be a reason or an opportunity for an Ashworth hearing, because if a defense attorney stood up in closing argument and pointed to any fact that had been developed no matter when in the trial and argued that it was mitigating and should justify a sentence less than death, that would make Ashworth inapplicable. So the conclusion would be that any time a defense attorney stood up and made an argument in advance of his claim that the death penalty shouldn't apply because of some particular fact, under the state's theory that they presented to you, then Ashworth would be inapplicable. And that's certainly not what this court intended when it wrote the Ashworth syllabus. What the court intended was to make certain that defendants who possibly would be under the stress of great litigation, their life on the line, were making clear, intelligent, smart choices, and that those choices weren't encumbered by an impaired mind. And again, under the state's theory of the case or the theory of the law, that particular requirement would be written out of it.
How much, Mr. Pagan, how much weight should we give? You touched on this, but how much weight should we give to the statement of the defendant about his desire to not serve more time in prison? He'd been there 10 years, he knew what it was like, and he makes a statement that life in prison would be a burden to all the citizens, their cost, wouldn't have anything to worry about. I'd get fed every day, have a roof over my head, free medical, so forth. Punishment would be to wake up every day and have a date with death. That's the only punishment for this crime. That's all I've got to say. And then he says, of course, he would rather have the death penalty. How much weight should we give that? I know the argument always is, well, somebody doesn't talk that way unless they're mentally imbalanced or something wrong with them, but we've had other experiences with that, obviously, where the defendant chooses to, knowing that they've committed the crime and knowing that they're going to die eventually. And how much should we not give that any weight in determining?
Well, I do appreciate your point, and I certainly can't stand up here today and argue that it's an unreasoned point, because it does make sense. And I also appreciate the law that's developed and the policy that's been developed in these types of cases wherein the court has indicated that it's appropriate to honor a defendant's wishes even where they wish or intend to die. I appreciate that. But I would submit to the court that the presentation of a basis or a rationale for his wish is not the same as a knowing and intelligent waiver of his rights. He's attached some reasoning to it, but it doesn't at all address whether or not he was appreciative of the gravity of it. And I guess
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, if he has decided in his own mind and if we agree for purposes of this argument that he knows what he's doing, it's an intelligent decision. I would rather be put to death and sit here in prison for however many years. If that's really his choice, then he's probably not going to want to offer mitigation, is he?
No.
Mitigation goes to just against that wish.
Here's how I would respond to that. Mr. Barton has demonstrated in his life and in this record a dangerous impulsivity when it comes to choices of life and death. He tried to kill himself. Now, we know, because I'm here today, that he hasn't tried to kill himself since. So he made a choice at one time to take his life, and now has backed away from it. At the point in time, and for a long period of time that I was involved in this case, Mr. Barton did want to die. He does not take that position today. He has changed his mind and has asked me and has required me to go and appear in front of you here today to attempt to get him a new sentencing hearing. So he said one thing on the record. He has now changed his mind. And that suggests the exact reason why we need to have protections like Ashworth. because had there been an Ashworth hearing or had there been a competency evaluation, I am confident that that dangerous impulsivity could have been presented to the trial court and would have been the break and would have required required the trial court to take the protections set out or invoked in law to make certain that that was his choice.
How do we reconcile your statement you just made with his motion that he filed with us to still waive his appeals? Has he withdrawn that?
I don't know that he's specifically withdrawn it, and this is certainly not in the record, so you can take this for what you will. But he has represented to me in correspondence that he is no longer taking that position. And quite frankly, because he's in prison, he's now receiving psychiatric treatment, and he's now being medicated. He's been diagnosed, and he's now getting medicated. So his connection and posturing to me is completely different than prior.
But he still has not withdrawn his motion to waive his appeals.
He has not withdrawn that motion, but on my advice, he will if that's what it takes, because I know what his true intentions are now. And I think that that's kind of the whole point of the Ashworth hearing is to ferret these things out, and it's inappropriate for us to be in the position here to be second guessing as to what his mental state is and what his true intentions were. And that's why we have the procedures that we have that should be conducted prior to the mitigation hearing, so we're
counsel,
not in a position.
Counsel, the distinction with Ashworth was that he pled guilty, Ashworth did, and there was no evidence presented, none was necessary. There was no mitigation evidence at that point. The failure to inquire as to the voluntariness of the procedure, how do you reconcile the distinctions in Ashworth that made Ashworth valid compared to the course of conduct with this? There was a not guilty plea. There was a trial. Certainly, mitigation evidence was presented during the trial phase. His relationship with Jamie and coworkers and supervisors and just a picture was painted for the jury of who this person was and the relationship. And you referred to dangerous impulsivity. Certainly, the death of his wife, Kimberly, is a prime example of dangerous impulsivity.
Correct.
But that information was shared with the jury, which I believe they're entitled to consider in the mitigation phase, even though it was not presented during that time. Jordan says that is certainly
I agree with that.
Something that they can consider. So given the totality of this man's experience with the justice system and what transpired both during the trial phase and the mitigation phase, how can you say that Ashworth is on all four with Barton, or vice versa, I should say?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's necessary for a defendant to plead guilty to trigger the protections of Ashworth. I don't think Ashworth said that, and I think that would be a dangerous precedent if the court were to follow that. And in fact, Ashworth has been applied in many circumstances in which there was a trial on the merits, and in fact, it was only after the trial that the defendant became so overwhelmed or beleaguered by the guilty verdict and facing the death penalty that he chose at that particular point in time not to present mitigation. So if that's the distinction, I don't think that's an appropriate distinction, and I would point to Cowens. Mr. Cowens had a trial. Mr. Vrabel, in the Vrabel case, he had a trial, and Mr. Jordan had a trial. And Mink pled guilty, and Ashworth pled guilty. So of the five cases that are precedent, three of them had trials on the merits, and two of them didn't. So that's not a distinction. And I think that, again, the Ashworth decision requires you to consider whether or not all mitigating evidence was waived. That decision, I would submit to you, is to be made at the point in time that mitigation is to begin.
Well, but Jordan says that you can consider the evidence presented at trial in the mitigation phase, which triggers the determination that all mitigation was not waived because of the positives that were spoken about this defendant during the trial phase.
I understand.
Was that mitigation evidence that the jury considered?
It was argued. I would imagine that they did consider it.
Mitigation was not waived. All mitigation was not waived here.
the beginning of Ashworth syllabus would refute what you're saying. It's in the beginning of the Ashworth syllabus says, when the defendant wishes to waive all mitigating evidence. When defense counsel got up and cross-examined that particular witness, he was on his own. He was operating against the intentions, the express intentions that Mr. Barton had provided. And we had a circumstance in this particular case where Mr. Barton was suffering from an undiagnosed mental illness where he took the position, like a depressed person does, you go do what you're going to do, I'm not going to help you. I'm just going to sit here and take it as it comes. And that is the particular type of person, that's who Mr. Barton was, and that's how he's been diagnosed in prison. And that's the particular type of person who needs the protections of Ashworth. So I'm suggesting to you that the focus of Ashworth is on the defendant's intentions and not defense counsel. And I'd also point out that the test that you suggest would render Ashworth inapplicable in all circumstances, because there's always going to be circumstances in a trial where something favorable comes up that you can, in a resourceful way, argue, if you have to, as defense counsel, in closing argument that, hey, the guy's not so bad. I mean, you could argue that because Mr. Barton sat there and didn't utter a peep during the trial, that was suggestive of somebody who was respectful of the court system. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. And if it,
but that's not a mitigation. Respectful of the court system is not one of the criteria to take in consideration here.
I would have argued it. I mean, if I had to, you know, because sometimes, in cases like this, you get a lot of hopeless cases. But again, if you focus on the totality of the record and hope to be able to divine whether or not something was intended to be mitigating or not when it was submitted for other purposes and in circumstances that are ambiguous or you would have to speculate on, Ashworth would be eaten up or swallowed. So I think that the appropriate way, and I think this is what Ashworth says, is at the time of mitigation, prospectively, if the defendant wishes to waive all mitigating evidence at that particular point, then there needs to be the Ashworth hearing, and if there's the indicia of incompetence, then there needs to be a competency evaluation.
You're essentially arguing that there was procedural error in not providing the hearing when there was going to be no additional witnesses called for the mitigation hearing? I mean, that's why I'm saying the unsworn statement is there, and you're saying look to the content to see if that's mitigating.
Yes.
But if there are no witnesses that are going to be called in mitigation at the trial, at the penalty phase, you're saying that's the point that the judge needs to have the Ashworth hearing.
Correct. And in the five cases that are precedent, that's when those hearings occurred, and Ashworth stands for the proposition if that hearing isn't provided for, then there's not record evidence of a knowing and an intelligent waiver. So that's the procedure that's required, and there was procedural error in the failure to conduct that hearing, correct? And I do want to point out that I read Ashworth as being bifurcated. There's the hearing where there needs to be a colloquy or a written waiver with the six discrete questions asked and findings of fact, and that that didn't happen here. But there's also the competency prong of Ashworth, which requires a competency evaluation if there is the indicia of incompetency on the record. And I would, so those are two discrete things, and those two discrete things did not happen here. And there was indicia of incompetence. And you know, what's critical to me, and I think that the court should take strong note of this, I've talked about the five different precedent, Mink, Jordan, Vrabel, Cowens, and Ashworth. In all five of those cases, there were Ashworth hearings. We did not have one in our case. In three of the five cases, Mink, Vrabel, and Ashworth, there were competency evaluations. In the two remaining, the three that there weren't competency evaluations, the trial court made specific findings relating to the defendant's competence. In other words, in Jordan, there was a trial court holding or finding that the defendant presented in an intelligent way and understood what he was doing in the course of the trial. And in Cowens, there was a similar finding. So there was either a competency evaluation or trial court findings reflecting or probative of competence in all five cases. We don't have any of those things in our particular case, despite the fact that the defendant attempted to commit suicide during the course of his crime, which I would submit is sufficient indicia of incompetence that would require, at the minimum, a competency evaluation. I see that I only have 6 minutes left. I would really like to reserve some time for rebuttal. So if the court has any other questions, I'll take them at this time, but I'd like to sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Pagan.
Thank you.
Mr. Hutzel. Ms. Hutzel, excuse me, should have looked up.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Rachel Hutzel. I'm the Warren County Prosecutor. My co-counsel is Andy Sievers. We're here representing the state of Ohio, and we also tried this case at the trial phase. The defendant, Rocky Barton, through counsel, has advanced four propositions of law. None of these justify reversal of the death penalty or remand for sentencing. With respect to the defendant's first proposition of law, the defendant did not weigh all mitigation. Therefore, the court did not have to determine if the waiver was voluntary and knowing. The defendant specifically said to his counsel, and counsel shared this with the court before mitigation, I don't want you to call the psychological expert, who, by the way, spent 4 to 6 hours with the defendant, and I don't want you to call my family in mitigation. That is what he said. The defendant did allow objections throughout trial, and they were effectively used. He allowed cross-examination of all witnesses, also effectively used. He made an unsworn statement, and he allowed argument at the penalty phase, which importantly reminded the jury of evidence that had been raised in mitigation during cross-examination.
Ms. Hutzel, though, looking at Ashworth and looking at the holding there, it seems to be clear that the court was saying that if there are not going to be the expert witness called, and if there is not going to be family witnesses called at the mitigation hearing, the court is to inquire on the record if the defendant really knows what mitigation is all about and make the various have the colloquy that is called for in Ashworth. How do you respond to that?
First, Your Honor, Ashworth can be distinguished easily from this case. First, in Ashworth, there were no objections that were permitted by the defendant. There was no cross-examination. There was no statement, unsworn or otherwise, from the defendant. And there was no argument bringing to the jury's attention the mitigating evidence that had been raised during the trial phase. So in Ashworth, first, there was a complete waiver of all mitigation. That is not the case here. Additionally, in order to go through the competency evaluation, there has to be two prongs, as counsel correctly pointed, and that is that there is sufficient indicia of incompetence and that there is a complete waiver. And what I would submit to this court is there was not a complete waiver, and there was not indicia of incompetence in this case.
So you would have us limit the holding in Ashworth? I mean, if we were to affirm, we would have to, in some way, distinguish Ashworth and perhaps limit it in the fashion that you're suggesting.
I think Ashworth, Your Honor, has already been limited mm-hmm. in that fashion. First, Ashworth, as I mentioned, can be distinguished factually from this case. There was a lot of mitigation offered in this case that was not permitted by the defendant in Ashworth. And second, it was a two-pronged test where there was both the sufficient indicia of incompetence as well as the complete waiver, neither of which we had in the Barton case.
So is it your view then that Ashworth doesn't apply to this case?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is my view. I would also submit to the court that the Cowens and Jordan case are not on all fours with this case. In the Cowens and Jordan case, there was mitigation evidence at trial, and there was no argument at penalty, which at penalty phase in our case brought again to the jury's attention that mitigating evidence that was brought forth in cross-examination. That is very different from the Cowens case and the Jordan case. Additionally, and counsel has mentioned the Vrabel and the Mink cases, those are also not on all fours with this case. In Vrabel and Mink, there was an unsworn statement, but there was no argument at penalty. And I would submit to the court that that is different from the case that we had in Barton. Each of those five cases had a more complete waiver than we had in the Barton case. In the Barton case, there was not a complete waiver of all mitigation. Defense has also argued that evidence raised during trial is not mitigation, but counsel refers to it as mitigation evidence in their own reply brief. Trial counsel argued it at the beginning of the mitigation phase during the trial, and the judge also instructed the jury to consider all evidence. So the jury was reminded both by the judge and by trial counsel, there's all this evidence that was raised during trial phase. You should consider it in mitigation.
So your view is the single determination for the court to make is whether or not the defendant waived all mitigation, and if there was any, whether it be by argument, cross-examination during trial, or any other presentation at any point, statement sworn or unsworn by the defendant, any effort or any evidence of mitigation takes it out of the ambit of waiver of all mitigation.
Your Honor, is that your view?
I want to make sure I understand it.
Yes, Your Honor. The test is whether there was a complete waiver, and I would submit to this court that there was not a complete waiver.
A simple reading of the syllabus in Ashworth makes that support your argument. States in a capital case when a defendant wishes to waive the presentation of all mitigating evidence, and we even italicize the word all, and that's not the case before us. There was mitigating evidence presented.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the second syllabus goes on that the defendant has to have the capacity to know what he's doing, to understand the choice between life and death, and in this case, he even gave his reasons why he did not
Yes, Your Honor. And that brings me to the second proposition of law that has been set forth.
Let me stop you there. Let me just pick up on that question. Why should we not extend Ashworth to the extent that we would say that where a defendant expresses a desire to be put to death, that there should there's a strong presumption in favor of an Ashworth instruction or hearing?
Your Honor, I don't know that the court would have to go that far. I think that in this case, and contrary to what defense counsel has said, this case from beginning to end is replete with indications that this defendant knew exactly what he was doing. And I would even suggest that there wasn't the dangerous impulsivity that defense counsel displays. The defendant planned the killing of his wife. He attempted to kill himself. When he failed to kill himself, he asked the court to do it. He stated in his own unsworn statement, "I've been to prison. I know what prison is like, and I don't want to go back there."
But as a matter of law, what's wrong with my suggestion? Let's take the facts of this case. We're obviously writing law here for other cases, and it may be that you may be correct that such a statement or holding wouldn't apply here because of the facts, because he seemed to know what he was doing. But I guess, should we be concerned that in the next case where somebody's perhaps is equivocal about wanting to be put to death, which we have seen in the past, that it's not a whole lot to ask of a court to require an Ashworth hearing to be certain that the defendant really knows what he's doing? And when he says, I guess I question whether he thought of the cross-examination of his sister in the guilt phase as mitigation. You know, we have two, obviously, bifurcated trial, and we have a mitigation part of the trial for the proceeding, and that's really usually where the mitigation testimony or evidence mm-hmm. is offered. What's wrong with just that extra precaution in a case where the defendant is doing something that seems counterintuitive to most of us?
probably nothing wrong with it, Your Honor. However, the test that has already been set out is that you do that Ashworth inquiry. You look into competence if there's indicia of incompetence and if there's been a complete waiver. And in this case, number one, there was not a complete waiver, and number two, there was not indicia of incompetence. There has to be, as this court and as Adams versus United States has said, some recognition of the defendant's right to be the determiner of their own fate. And what Adams versus U.S. said is to insist that he present mitigation, to force him to submit to a competency evaluation, is to imprison a man in his privileges and call it a constitution. The fact is, in this case, throughout the entire case, Barton gave every indication that he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew what he wanted. And in fact, as recently as September of 2004, in his affidavit to this court, he again indicated that he knew exactly what he wanted. Now, the fact that at this date, nearly 2 years later, he has some psychological evaluation should be, I believe, of no weight to this court. First of all, he's back in prison against his wishes, back in prison. And prison being a difficult place can affect someone's mental health, whether they wanted that or not. Number two, things can change in a person's life even if you're not in prison, such that you could develop some mental illness. In addition, no indication throughout the record in this case that he had any mental illness or any psychosis. Further, this court has even said that mental illness and psychosis do not equate with incompetence, and that was in the Vrabel case. This court has also said that suicide attempts do not equate incompetence, and that was in the Mink case. This case is easily distinguishable from those five cases that were mentioned by defense counsel. Again, there has to be both a complete waiver and some indicia of incompetence, and I would submit to this court that there was no indicia of incompetence from Mr. Barton throughout this case, really from beginning to end.
For Ashworth to apply here, he would have to have somehow prevented the cross-examination of the persons who gave the mitigation evidence in the guilt phase, wouldn't he?
I believe that would be one way that he could have indicated a complete waiver.
How would he have done that?
He could have requested that his counsel not cross-examine. And in fact, counsel stood up at the beginning of the mitigation phase and said, what he has asked us to do is not to present his family in the mitigation phase, although his family had already testified, and not to present testimony from the expert witness who spent 4 to 6 hours with him. That is all that defense counsel mentioned that he had requested by way of waiving mitigation. That's all.
But what occurred... Well, counsel, ultimate waiver would have been a guilty plea, which he did not do at this point.
That's correct, Your Honor. As you pointed out earlier, he pled not guilty. He did not make an insanity plea. He did not file a suggestion of incompetence. He did not display outrageous or irrational behavior during trial. There was no concern raised about his competence by the psychologist who spent 4 to 6 hours with him. There was no concern of his competence raised by counsel during trial or by the judge during trial. In fact, he presented a well-reasoned, logical argument for the death penalty versus life imprisonment, and even shared his own personal experience that led him to that conclusion. He also, by way of logical reasoning, said that he believed in the death penalty and that his actions supported the death penalty. He did not want to go back to prison. He had already experienced it. He felt that he had committed a heinous crime and that he qualified for the death penalty, and he asked the court for that.
Under your broad reading of mitigating evidence, though, it sounds as though there'd hardly ever be an Ashworth inquiry required by the trial judge, because as soon as an individual went to trial and defense counsel got up and made the first cross-examination, that could be considered mitigating in your view, and the call on the trial judge to determine whether a waiver is voluntary would never be an issue.
Well, Your Honor, there were four cases mentioned earlier, actually five cases mentioned earlier by counsel: Ashworth, Vrabel, Jordans, Cowens, and Mink, where there was a much more complete waiver than in this case. In this case, at every step, he gave intention to the court, gave indication to the court that he wanted mitigation. And in fact, that was the way that the court proceeded.
Well, then, counsel, the test here is consistency. Consistency in the defendant's wishes being expressed and carried through by counsel. And here, because of the not guilty plea, because of the trial, because of the extent and content of cross-examination, and there's an inconsistency with a waiver.
Exactly, Your Honor. This court, this particular case, Barton, is very different from some of the other cases that have been in front of this court, where there was either an inconsistency or there was a consistency, and from beginning to end, there was an indication of a waiver. In this case, there is no indication from beginning to end, or little indication from beginning to end, that he wanted a waiver. In fact, his actions throughout the court would suggest exactly the opposite.
What consideration, then, do we give to the statement by Mr. Pagan that would appear as though Mr. Barton has had a change of heart, and though he has filed a motion with us to withdraw all appeals, he's now got a different view, and he's very anxious to prosecute and seek a new trial?
Yes, Your Honor, that may be. In September of 2004, though, in his affidavit to this court, he indicated that his intentions in September of 2004 were the same as they were in, I believe it was October of 2003. The other point that has to be made, though, is that this is 2 years later, 2 years since the trial. And the fact that he has now had a change of heart does not indicate that he did not know what was in his heart and his mind at the time of this trial. And that's the test that the court has to use. The issue was, did he want to make a waiver in October of 2003? And was there indicia of some sufficient indicia of incompetence in 2003, not in the fall of 2005, 2 years later? Additionally, in the Ashworth case, the court pointed out that one indicia of competence, if you will, is if the defendant, in requesting their sentence, requests something that is logically related to the end that the defendant sought. What is the end that the defendant in this case sought? The end that he sought was the death of his wife and the death of himself. And when he failed to commit suicide, as he tried to at the scene, he asked the court for death. He did not want prison. What he asked for of the court, the death penalty, was logically related to the end that he sought,
counsel,
as in the Ashworth case.
Counsel, the jury had in front of it from the start his prior criminal history, or some of it, did it not?
It had limited information of his prior criminal history, Your Honor.
And what was that?
What the court permitted the jury to know was that there was a prior attempted murder conviction out of Kentucky from 1991. No details of that, no information about the relationship between the defendant and the victim or the circumstances of that attempted murder.
And is that in the record at any place?
That is in the record, Your Honor.
I mean, the details.
The details are not in the record, Your Honor.
At any?
No,
not,
Your Honor.
Not in front of the jury, but it's not in the record that we have to review.
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I believe that.
So we're in the dark as to whether or not his prior conviction, which the jury was aware of, had any indicia wrapped in that of any kind of mental illness?
No, Your Honor, you would not be able to tell that from the prior conviction. But again, keep in mind that the prior conviction was 12 years before this occurred.
The jury knew about that prior conviction, not the substance.
The jury knew only that it was an attempted murder conviction out of Kentucky from 1991.
Okay, where I'm going with this, Your Honor, is last week a very forceful argument was made to this court that I'm going to paraphrase it or give my take on it, that we really have not been doing the independent weighing in the fashion that we're required to do as to whether or not death should be imposed. That's a statutory obligation on this court, irregardless of anything else that has happened in this case. We have to make an independent judgment as to whether or not death is appropriate in this case. The reason for my question is, when we address that part of the case, and here I'm getting fairly or unfairly that this gentleman wanted to commit suicide, and we ought to all step back and accommodate him, because that's really what you're saying he wanted to do. He wanted to now use the legal system to assist, you know, an assisted suicide. You may not like those choice of words, but that's the feel I'm getting for this case, and the feel I'm getting for your argument to us. We're not really permitted statutorily to do that. We're required to independently weigh, and just because he wants to be put to death, we're required to evaluate whether or not that's appropriate. Yeah. And you're indicating that we can't, there's nothing that's going to help us in this record about his background and his prior criminal history in terms of any indication of whether or not there was any degree of mental illness or mental instability mm-hmm. wrapped up in his prior conviction.
Your Honor, I believe the decision was made for tactical reasons by counsel to try the weapon spec which arose out of the prior conviction to the court for exactly that reason, because they did not want the details of the prior attempted murder, which involved his estranged wife, or ex-wife, I believe. The trial counsel made a determination to try that spec to the court to avoid having that information.
So the jury was not permitted to know, and it's not in the record that the victim was his estranged wife?
Correct. Or ex-wife. I believe it was ex-wife. Further.
So what you've just told us here is actually outside the record.
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
Counsel, addressing the concept that the state is merely assisting in a suicide wish by the defendant. The defendant's desire not to return to prison for the rest of his life is the basis that he justifies for not asking for consideration from this court for a life sentence. His basis for wishing to terminate his life was because of the murder of his wife, and his immediate response was to terminate his life by an attempted suicide because of what he had just accomplished, and that was the murder of his wife. Had his desire, his end goal, was to commit suicide, he certainly could have done that without killing his wife.
Yes, Your Honor.
His crime of killing his wife triggered his desire to attempt suicide so as not to go to prison, not I want to kill myself, independent of what I had just done.
I think that that's correct, and I believe that there is testimony in the record to that effect, because he was quoted by one of the witnesses, possibly two of the witnesses at the scene, his stepdaughter and his uncle, as saying, I'm not going back to prison. Right. Or at least during the course of the day of the murder, saying, I am not going to go back to prison. And in answer to Justice Pfeiffer's question, I am not suggesting that this court or any court assist someone in committing suicide. I think that that would be a callous thing to say. The point that I'm trying to make, though, is that the suicide attempt alone does not, in this case or in other cases that the court has considered, indicate by itself that the person is incompetent. And in fact, you have in fact hit on a good point, Your Honor, and that is that he had logical reasons to attempt the suicide after he killed his wife and to ask the court for the death penalty. And he really gave several reasons. One was he knew what he was facing in prison. He had been there before. He had killed his wife, so you could assume from that that his family is essentially broken. And he believed in the death penalty, felt that he had committed a crime that deserved the death penalty. Those are not the statements of someone who is out of touch with reality.
Counsel, then what you say is that the unsworn statement really could be considered mitigation insofar as an expression of remorse was made?
Your Honor, it was treated as mitigation by defense counsel. Defense counsel specifically said to the jury, don't do what he has asked for in mitigation. What I would suggest about the statement in addition to that is that it also shows that he was not incompetent, that he was competent, because it was logically related to his end. It was well-reasoned. It was logically laid out. He made several arguments for why he should have the death penalty. So I would suggest, and this court has previously found, that the suicide attempt alone and the waiver alone are not by themselves an indication of incompetence, such that an inquiry would need to be waived, would need to be made. I would also, again, remind the court that in terms of forcing a person to have a competency evaluation, what the Supreme Court has said is that, again, you have to allow some self-determination. You cannot imprison a man in his privileges and call it a constitution. I see that I have only 2 minutes left. I would like to briefly address the third proposition.
Counsel, it strikes me, it seems ironic, that you're arguing that your position is actually granting him mercy in this case, because he regards life in prison as a penalty more severe than death.
That is, in essence, the statement that he made, Your Honor. If I could briefly address the third proposition, the defendant was not denied counsel when he gave an unsworn statement without a question and answer format. This court in Lynch said that there is no constitutional right to a question and answer format, and the court may, in its discretion, permit a question and answer format. The standard, therefore, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. So absent an arbitrary, unreasonable, or unconscionable decision by the court, that decision should be allowed to stand.
The question and answer format, he has a right to take the stand under oath and go have his attorney question him, does he not?
Yes, Your Honor.
It really only applies to an unsworn statement. So he was not deprived of a sworn statement right to take the stand, be fully cross-examined, have his attorney ask him questions, and then be subject to cross-examination. And his choice to make an unsworn statement and forego those other aspects means he also gives up the right to have a required question and answer process, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact, there is no indication in this record that he even wanted a question and answer format. In fact, the record would suggest that he wanted exactly the opposite. At the beginning of the mitigation phase, his attorneys addressed the court and said, "We do not know what is in his statement. He has not allowed us to see what is in his statement." That's also consistent with the affidavit that he filed with this court in September of 2004. What those statements indicate is that he wanted, and I believe it was not to make a waiver, but what he wanted was to control how his request was addressed to the court. He did not give any indication that he would have even permitted a question and answer format, and he gave a logical, well-reasoned argument in his unsworn statement.
Thank you, Ms. Hudson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pagan, you saved almost 6 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Judge. A few brief points. First, I think that the prosecutor has misstated Ashworth, and I want to be clear what I submit Ashworth stands for, and that's two different propositions. One is there needs to be an Ashworth hearing on the record when there is a waiver of all mitigating evidence. There's no requirement of an indicia of incompetency for the hearing itself. That stands on its own. The indicia of incompetence is only triggers a mandatory competency evaluation. Now, I submit because there was the waiver of all mitigating evidence, there was no Ashworth hearing, which was required, and that there was an indicia of incompetence by virtue of the suicide attempt that required the competency evaluation. So I think that there are two issues, and I want the court to be clear about that.
What would you have this court do then as a remedy for your position?
Remand for a new sentencing hearing.
Right.
Well, let me strike that. Remand for a sentencing hearing, and there would be a colloquy initially by the trial court to determine whether or not the waiver was knowing and intelligent, and a competency evaluation conducted so that the court could make a determination as to whether or not, at the time the waiver was made of all mitigating evidence, Mr. Barton was incompetent. If the trial court would conclude that there was not a knowing and intelligent waiver, or that Mr. Barton was incompetent at the time, then there would be an invalid waiver and a new sentencing hearing. So specifically, that's what I'm requesting, that you remand for the Ashworth hearing and for a competency evaluation.
Well, counsel, you're indicating that the suicide was indicia of incompetency, correct?
Yes, certainly.
Wouldn't that incompetency relate back to the very act itself?
I don't think that I would be able to argue that there would be an indicia of incompetence in every aggravated murder with a death spec. So no, there has to be something besides the aggravated murder that would give, not prove incompetency, but just give the indicia. You know, there would have to be, you know, it's almost like a prima facie or some evidence besides the act itself to demonstrate incompetence. And this, the suicide attempt, is that. So I would say no to your question. Just the murder itself is an indicia. It wouldn't be, in other words, you'd have to have an Ashworth hearing in every case whenever there'd be a waiver. Strike that. There would have to be a competency evaluation no matter what, and because of a murder.
Every time there's a murder, there should be a competency evaluation.
No, there shouldn't be. Absolutely not.
But if there's a murder followed, you know, 2 minutes later by a suicide attempt, there should be a competency evaluation?
Almost certainly, yes, because that's indicia of mental instability. The act of harming oneself certainly suggests that there is a psychological problem that the court...
Some would argue this type of crime perpetrated against the victim is indicia of...
Some would argue that,
imbalance.
But I'm relying upon your jurisprudence.
So if you're going to harm yourself, that points to incompetency. But if you're going to heinously murder someone else, that's not indicia of incompetence.
Under your rulings, no. Right. Now, I know that Chief Justice Moyer has indicated that he, in I think it was the Cowens case, he would take the position that there should be a competency evaluation anytime. But that, and I think that that would be appropriate, but that's not the law of the state. The law of the state is some indicia besides waiving.
So you would like to make it the law of the state that whenever there's a suicide attempt, that it triggers a competency hearing?
I think the difference between my position and the state's position is I'm asking you to apply Ashworth as it is now. And I'm suggesting to you that indicia of incompetence is the standard, and that the facts presented in this case, which is the suicide attempt, is a factual thing that satisfies the indicia standard. And I'm asking that that be the law of the state.
Didn't have the suicide attempt here? Yeah.
Then I'd have some problems on the competency.
Well, yeah, obviously.
But I wouldn't have
problems. How about the language of Ashwood where it says all mitigating, and again, as Justice Resnick pointed out, the italicized, the emphasized word all?
I think that I have to demonstrate that here before you, that there had to be a waiver of all mitigating evidence, and I would submit that there has been, and I think here's where I think that the state is trying to limit Ashworth, and I'm asking you to apply it, because there's been discussion from the bench and from the government's table that things like objections and arguments and NGRI pleas and not guilty pleas are some way relevant to your analysis, but Ashworth doesn't say that. Ashworth talks about evidence, not things that counsel does, not objections, not trial behavior by attorneys, but evidence. And not only just evidence, but mitigating evidence. And that distinction has been made by your court again and again. In Vrabel, he made a statement, an unsworn statement, and you called it evidence, which it is, but it's not mitigating.
You didn't really mean what you said in response to Justice O'Connor when you said that it was the suicide attempt that triggered the need for an incompetency hearing.
Did I mean that?
Yeah, did you mean that?
No, I did mean that because I think that that's indicia of incompetence.
Well, Ashworth doesn't hold that. Ashworth holds that if there's a waiver of all mitigating evidence. So I don't quite understand your argument on that point.
Just if I could finish up one second. Ashworth hearing requires the waiver of all mitigating evidence. I agree with that. A competency evaluation is required when there's the waiver of all mitigating evidence and there's the indicia of incompetence.
And your point is the mitigating evidence occurs during the penalty phase, is that correct? Or are you saying that there can be mitigating evidence provided in the direct, the point of trial where the jury decides of conviction or not?
Mitigating evidence is occurs during the penalty phase.
Not the guilt phase.
No.
So no matter how much no matter how much mitigating evidence there is in the guilt phase, you would not credit that as mitigating evidence.
And the reason for that is because it's not relevant and it's not admissible in the guilt phase. The guilt phase is to determine whether or not the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of aggravated murder in a speck. So all that evidence is probative of that particular issue. If there was even the attempt of mitigating evidence to be presented, it would be irrelevant and it should be excluded by the trial court.
It may not be presented as mitigating evidence, but as you know, oftentimes in the guilt phase, there is evidence offered that places the defendant in a favorable light, if you will, for lack of a better term.
Right.
I mean, you can go through a record, as you mentioned, you can go through a record and find pieces of mitigating evidence in the guilt phase sometimes.
Correct.
And you're saying that that shouldn't be, because it's not the discrete part of the process in which the defendant is now able to offer mitigating evidence.
Exactly. It's being presented for a trial purpose.
All right, counsel, would you like to see a limiting instruction then from the court to the jury that they are not to consider any positive evidence that has been elicited from the witnesses in relationship to the mitigation or the for their consideration?
No, I don't think that there would be a need for a mitigating instruction. And secondly, I think the statute...
A limiting instruction.
A limiting instruction during the trial phase?
No, at the time of the mitigation.
Yes.
If you're saying that all of the positives, and I use the term...
I know what you mean.
Whatever positives that can be elicited regarding some defendants, you say are not to be considered by the jury in mitigation, that would... seems to me, require a limited instruction from the judge to the jurors to totally disregard any positives they heard during the trial phase and focus solely on the evidence that comes before them in the second phase, the mitigating phase.
I don't think that limiting instruction would be lawful because this court has held and the statute 2929, I don't have it in front of me, I think 04B or 03D1, I think, says that mitigating evidence can come from anywhere. And I think what this court needs to require is that trial courts, when they conduct trials, to allow evidence to be probative only of the aggravated murder in the spec. And
if something comes in for evidence, if mitigating evidence can come from, when they say anywhere, obviously it's on the record in the trial.
Correct.
And that doesn't comport with the statement you made earlier in response to a question that the trial phase evidence, no matter how favorable, was not mitigating evidence.
It wasn't intended by the defendant to be presented as mitigating evidence, which is what the Ashworth syllabus talks about. When the defendant wishes to waive all mitigating evidence, I know I'm way over my time here, but you know, the defendant didn't try his case, an attorney did, and what he does during trial, and when he elicits evidence for a particular trial purpose, Barton had no control over, and that's important to consider, I think.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
May I ask one more question? The five cases that you're referring to, because I think this all mitigating evidence is very important. To clarify, all five cases that you're talking about, we're talking about the presentation of witnesses in the penalty phase on behalf of the defendant, are we
right.
not?
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pagan. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.